It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later in the program, we'll be talking about the tax climate here in Wisconsin.
But first, a look at the life and career of Duke Ellington. He's well known as a legend in the jazz world, considered one of the best composers of the 20th century, but the man himself was a bit of an enigma. A new biography hopes to shed some light on who he actually was.
Joining us now is Terry Teachout. He's the drama critic for the Wall Street Journal and the author of Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. Terry, welcome to Central Time.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, we just opened with the strains of Mood Indigo. Well, can you tell us about that iconic piece?
Well, it is, I think, probably the Ellington song that's best known throughout the world, the one with which he is most closely identified. And it's one that has a largely unacknowledged collaborator. Ellington was not the only person who wrote it. And that's one of the interesting themes in my book, is the extent to which Ellington's creative process is collaborative.
Well, let's run with that. Talk about his creative, collaborative process and how there may have been some unsung heroes along with him.
Very much so. Billy Strayhorn, the most important of Ellington's collaborators, said that Ellington plays the piano, that his real instrument is the orchestra. He wrote all of his music for specific performers, specific instrumental lineups, particular, very distinctive instrumental voices. That's something that he did throughout his career. He wrote roughly, we think he left behind about 1,700 compositions. Of these, most of them are instrumentals, and most of them are entirely by him. But he also wrote a very large number of quite successful pop songs, Mood Indigo being maybe the first of them. And in most of these songs, the songs like Mood Indigo, A Sophisticated Lady, In a Sentimental Mood, for which he is especially well known, the melodic material is written in whole or in part by members of his band.
And you call that collaborative. Is that a generous word? You know, I wonder how these band members would feel about it. Apparently, they didn't often get a lot of compensation when he used a bit of their tunes.
Well, it depended on the specific case and the specific musician. Some people were flattered that Ellington wanted to transform bits of melody that they might improvise on the bandstand into pop tunes. Now, others were not so happy, and one, Lawrence Brown, the trombone player, who wrote half of the melody of Sophisticated Lady and was paid a grand total of $25 for it, really never forgave Ellington for what he regarded as very sharp practice.
It's an interesting thought about creativity. I mean, you've got the soloist improvising maybe a different solo every time. Does it take away from Ellington's genius if you know that he saw that piece in there that was the gem, the diamond in the rough?
Not in the slightest, and that's very important to remember, to keep in mind in reading this book, is that Ellington's genius is a given. There's no question about it. It's true that, to take the specific case of Sophisticated Lady, Lawrence Brown wrote the first eight bars, and Otto Hardwick, the alto saxophone, wrote the second eight bars. But it was Ellington who had the idea to put those two pieces of melody together into a 32-bar song, who wrote the arrangement, who structured it, who transformed it from two isolated bits of melody into a full-fledged composition. And the question was it right that he should have paid them $25 a piece, flat fee, for the full rights to the song, and then suddenly their name isn't on the record label anymore? You must draw your own conclusions about that. But it doesn't diminish our sense of Ellington's great gifts as a composer, as a significant musical figure, to know that he did this kind of thing. How it makes us feel about him as a man may be a different story.
Let's give a little listen to a bit of Sophisticated Lady. We have a selection from it. So we heard those two four-bar pieces you mentioned that he spliced together from his two musicians and his orchestra. The two figures, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you mentioned the personality of Duke Ellington. Let's move on to that a little now. You write that Duke Ellington carried himself like a prince of the realm. How big a personality was this guy?
He was a mammoth personality. He was maybe the first really great, larger-than-life, charismatic figure to come along after Louis Armstrong in jazz. And the specific nature of that personality is central to understanding why he became the public figure that he did. Because Ellington presented himself and was promoted by Irving Mills, his first manager, as a man of great charisma, but also of great elegance, great suavity, beautifully spoken, beautifully dressed. And he was presented by Mills also as not just another run-of-the-mill black band leader from Harlem, but as a major composer, a figure of real cultural significance. That's what set Ellington apart in the 20s and 30s, and that image, which was crafted by Mills and was very compatible with Ellington's real-life personality, stuck with him for the rest of his life, and very profitably so, too.
You talked about his charisma and his bearing. He had a regal air about him. Is that part of how he was able to get some credibility for jazz? It wasn't necessarily the most respected art form at the time that he was on the scene.
Absolutely, and he was always thinking about respectability. Remember that Ellington, born in 1899, grew up in the black middle-class community of Washington, D.C. He was not like Louis Armstrong, who came from the roughest block in New Orleans, whose mother was a prostitute. Now, he was a man who valued respectability in his own personal life, even though he didn't always live by its tenets. He wanted to be seen as respectable, and he thought that respectability would project itself onto jazz. The word jazz itself, for Ellington's generation, was identified with sexual matters, with sexual intercourse. That's why he didn't like to use it to describe his music. He liked to call his music Negro folk music. He thought that that was classier, and he thought that it would increase respect for the music he played in the world community. And I think particularly in the white community, it was important to him that jazz not be treated just as a minority music for dancing, but as a music for the whole world, a music that was as serious in its own way as classical music.
And in his creative process as a composer, he was really trying to live up to that concept, wasn't he?
Yes, very much so. You understand that Ellington is not, he's not putting on airs. In the first place, he really is like this. In the second place, his music is a fusion of you might say, highbrow, middle-class, respectable, classy sounds, and the earthiness and directness of the blues, which is also part and parcel of the sound. Ellington believed that strong contrasts were one of the most important aspects of his style, and you see them in his music all the time.
So he has that air that you're talking about, and he had the credibility that he brought to jazz and the respectability. On the other hand, reading about his life, when you've only heard his music, it's kind of difficult because he did have, you know, a womanizing side to his personality, a side that was not always that generous, it seems like, to his fellow bandmates. How was it for you as a biographer, sort of uncovering that side of Duke Ellington?
Mm-hmm. That's very much the case. The front cover of Duke is a photograph, very rarely seen, that dramatizes the sides of Ellington. You know, he's seen in profile. You know, he's composing, got a pencil in his hand, working on a piece of music. But you see the side of his face, the left side, that you don't normally see when he sees a piano on stage, and you see that there is a large crescent-shaped scar on his left cheek. Well, Duke tells the story of how he got that scar, which briefly is that around 1927 or 28, his wife, who found out that he was catting around pretty aggressively, went after him with a razor in bed one night and said, "I know what you've been up to, and I'm going to spoil those pretty looks." He was out the door seconds later, didn't even stop to put his clothes on, and he carried that scar with him for the rest of his life. It's a reminder of the high price of paying a life, of leading a life that is respectable on one side of the coin, less so on the other.
We're talking with Terry Teachout about jazz great Duke Ellington, and you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of Duke Ellington? Do you have a favorite song, a favorite composition? Do you have a question about his life? Give a call, 800-642-1234, or email talk@WPR.org.
We'll take your calls right after this break. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now about Duke Ellington with Terry Teachout. He's drama critic for The Wall Street Journal. His new book is called Duke. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your questions about Duke Ellington or maybe a favorite composition. 800-642-1234. We're going to check out probably his most famous piece. So we're in the bridge of Take the A Train there, co-written with Billy Strayhorn. And I wanted to talk about Billy Strayhorn a little more. You mentioned him briefly earlier. How important a collaborator for Duke Ellington was Billy?
He was the most important of Ellington's collaborators. He came on board with the band in 1939 as a very young man. Ellington immediately saw his potential, and Strayhorn became the band's chief arranger and co-composer. So valued by Ellington that, as we just heard, he actually wrote the band's theme song, Take the A-Train. But Strayhorn was a figure who did not appear with the band in public. Basically, he functioned in the shadows, wrote music, sent it in. Ellington played it. Ellington gave him credit, but since Strayhorn wasn't there, people tended to suppose that the music was by Ellington instead of by Strayhorn. And what was going on here was that Strayhorn was homosexual, and he knew that he could not really lead a public life as a musician back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and then also lead the kind of private life that he wanted to lead, because he was very much at ease with his sexuality. So he stayed out of the spotlight, left it to Ellington, and as a result, Ellington too often got the credit for things that Strayhorn actually wrote himself.
It sounds like they had kind of a rocky relationship, too, and I've read, you know, he wrote some cutting remarks that Duke Ellington made to him, you know, to the effect of, well, you're more of a behind-the-scenes guy anyway, more of a contributor, and I'm sort of the front man. Did that make things more hard?
Well, it was just going to be a complicated relationship anyway, because it started out as a father-son relationship. Strayhorn had an abusive father. He meets Ellington, the great genius. Now, they really take to each other. Ellington opens up the great world of professional music to him. And whenever you have a father-son relationship between two very gifted people, strains inevitably creep into the process. Eventually, Strayhorn became uncomfortable with the so-to-speak, bargain that he worked out. And in the 50s, he actually broke with the band for a few years. They worked it out, and Strayhorn remained with the band, writing for Ellington for the rest of his life. But it was a relationship that was not without its difficulties.
We'll go to the phones now. We have Chris with us in Evansville. Chris, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I guess I just wanted to say, first of all, I've had a lifelong love of Duke Ellington's music ever since I've been a child, mainly due, I guess, to my father's love of the music and having it in our house all the time. And I remember reading a biography of Duke Ellington, and I wish I could remember the author, but I can't. And in this book, it was talking about an incident where he and his band were staying at a hotel, and one of the other band members was making a remark about a woman at the hotel and calling her a whore. And Duke Ellington's comment was, "Don't you realize that when you look into her eyes, you may be looking into the eyes of God?" And I just, he seems to be a man of such contrast. Mm-hmm. And I do know that he wrote a religious piece. And I wonder if you could make a comment about that, as well as maybe some of his spiritual beliefs.
I'm glad you brought that up, because it hasn't come up in this conversation yet. But Ellington, for all his devoted pursuit of women, was also, in his idiosyncratic way, quite devoutly religious. Later in life, he wrote three full-length works called Sacred Concerts that were expositions of his faith. He was absolutely serious about it. It did not stop him from pursuing the ladies. But he was a complicated man who, as Whitman says, could contain multitudes. And he could contain both the carnality of his sex life and the spirituality of his religious life. And he was at ease with both sides of his personality.
Is that why you were laughing, Terry? The contradiction sort of inherent there in what you know about him?
Yes, but also, Ellington, he was a guy who knew what to say at any given moment, and he liked to say it in as elegant and polished a way as possible. And I chuckled at the thought of Ellington, you know, being challenged about a particular woman, and what he comes back with immediately, as was his way, was a compliment.
Mm-hmm. Talking about how Ellington talks, I was wondering if it makes it hard to be a biographer of him. You recount a story, I think, in the introduction, where Duke Ellington is talking about a song he wrote, Harlem, in the title, and how you can hear the sounds of Harlem and so on. But actually, the song had a completely different title when it was composed, so that wasn't what it was about at all. Is that a common theme in trying to write about Ellington?
Well, I think what it points to is that you can never take what Duke Ellington says about himself, about his music, you know, about the time of day at face value. Somewhere in the book I say that he was a man who spoke not to reveal himself, but to conceal himself. He was intensely private. He had a lot of secrets to keep. But his personality was fundamentally oriented that way anyway. So when you're writing about him, you just have to remember that he may or may not at any given moment be telling the truth. He may be embellishing it. He may be making it up completely. You check his statements out.
Let's give another listen to a song. It's a shame to talk about Duke Ellington so much and not play a little more music. How about In a Sentimental Mood?
Oh, yes.
So I play saxophone on a level that would not be tolerated in Duke's orchestra, but I have played that song, and it's a wonderful melody. Can you talk about that one a little?
Yes. Well, in fact, the man you heard playing the melody, Otto Hardwig, is the man who wrote the melody. Once again, as was Sophisticated Lady, Ellington's contribution to the proceedings here was to take a melodic fragment gleaned from the playing of one of his musicians and transform it into a full-scale composition. It's also, just put it this way, not a bit bluesy. It's not any kind of cliche notion of jazz, or for that matter, of blackness. It is explicitly, deliberately sentimental, and Ellington said, when challenged on this, that that too was a part of the black personality. He understood that there are no simple answers to the question, what does it mean to be a black person? And he wouldn't settle for them in his life or in his work.
I want to take another phone call. We have Randy on the line from Madison. Hi, Randy.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I was compelled to call because that put me in a nostalgic mood. I had a chance to meet Duke Ellington in 1972 after one of his concerts at Camp Pendleton, California. It cost me all of $2 to go see him, and I only had a few moments to talk to him, of course. But I also sought out Paul Gonzalez because I was quite a fan of his. And we talked for quite a while, and I got some real insight the fact that none of the band members were youngsters, and they had this grueling tour schedule that I could barely, was more common to rock and roll bands, and I was seeing that they liked Paul Gonzalez was the man who introduced me to Jack Daniels, but I could see that a lot of them really liked their liquor, but I guess I was just calling because, like I said, that's a really fond memory for me. But I also wonder, what was it like touring practically up to the time he died?
That's a great question, Randy. What about his touring schedule?
Well, it was grueling. There's a photograph in my book of Ellington taken in the late 60s. It's one of the few unposed casual photographs of him we have. And he's standing up in front of the band. He's at a rehearsal. His collar is unbuttoned, and he looks old and tired. And you can see the results that this kind of grueling schedule had had on him. On the other hand, for the most part, he really thrived on it because that was the life he liked, and that was the life he knew. He used to say, "I only go home to pick up my mail." And he wasn't going home to compose either. He wasn't composing in the privacy of his studio. He was composing in his hotel room. He was composing backstage at theaters or in nightclubs, dressing rooms. That was the way he operated. He wanted to have that band there every night to play the music he'd written that afternoon or the night before. That was the way he wanted to lead his life.
Just briefly, you end your book by observing that when it comes to Duke, everyone knows him, yet no one knows him. in doing this research, writing this extensive biography, do you feel like you know him?
I feel like I know some things about him. I think I know him a lot better than I did when I started working on the book. But I can say no better than all of the people whom I quote, friends, lovers, colleagues in the book, who all agree that they didn't really feel in the end that they knew what he was like on the inside.
All right, well, we'll leave it there and we'll go out with some music by Duke Ellington. Terry, thank you so much for joining us today.
That was a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Terry Teachout. He's the author of Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington.
Coming up next, we'll take a look at Wisconsin's tax climate. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.